Welcome to Reconsider. I'm Bill Hartman. This is the podcast to challenge you to ask better questions, to look beyond traditional models of thinking and arrive at better health and fitness solutions.
Wait.
Shoes, footwear, what's good?
Shoes. What a surprise. What's bad? What a surprise.
What do you do to pick the correct shoe? What type of shoe should you wear based on if you have flat feet or high arches? Which shoe is best for athletes? Which shoe is best for gaining ranges of motion and relative motion? Which best for performance? Are barefoot shoes good? Are orthotics necessary for people? All of these questions answered and more on today's episode of Reconsider.
Do you even
with
need
Bill
shoes?
Hartman.
Do you?
But it's something that we should definitely get into. Every time that I consult with someone, I talk to them and look at how they move around, I always have to have a conversation about footwear. And a lot of times, since there's such a big marketing thing with footwear these days, people think that that's the best shoe. So you have a lot of these bendy, foldable cloud shoes. People gravitate towards that because they see it often in their Instagram feeds and stuff like that.
Yes.
They say that barefoot shoes are better for you, or they say that minimalist shoes are better for you. It's just a matter of it's context dependent, obviously. And it's going to be based on what your foot does as you go through early, middle, and late propulsion, what your foot doesn't do.
Yes.
And I guess maybe we'll start there.
It's okay. So think about this for a second. So if you look at the shoe research and what they'll do is they'll take a singular person and they will put them in different types of shoes. Okay. And then they actually do these horrible things to people where they put bone markers in their feet. Right. So you got to screw stuff into their feet. Right. And then they monitor those markers and they go, oh, the foot does this if I put you in this type of a shoe. The foot does this if I put you in another type of a shoe. And here's what you find. Generally speaking, it ain't the shoe that changes the foot. But the upstream effects from the foot become the big deal. That's why we have concerns, right? So yes, we'll talk about subtle differences in foot behaviors. And I think that the reason that you don't see these massive changes in feet is because they're really small changes that would have big effects upstream. And so the difference is, when you look at the way that research is done and you're looking for like what is the most significant difference, it's like they're going to be so small a difference at the foot level, but everything is going to get magnified as we move from the foot upward. So it's like looking at knees and we're looking at hips and pelvises and such like that, right? And so I think that's why they would say that there's not a whole lot of difference like the shoe doesn't affect the foot behavior all that much, but it does affect upstream. I think that it's an unfortunate consequence that the differences are so small in the foot that we can't say that they're significant. And I would argue that there probably are significant because of the way that the sensation would work, the points of pressure that we would feel in an early, middle, or late representation that does make a pretty big difference. Because I think some of the things that are represented in the foot are not appreciated for how they do affect like when you look at somebody's big toe and you can get a gist of like how their knee's moving from that, it's like that's pretty impressive, but I don't think that that's the perspective that they would look at in the shoe research.
Right. Well, I was going to take a stab at the perspective that I think they're looking at the foot from is they want this static representation of a foot with an arch that looks squared wherever that like the heel looks squared, the forefoot looks squared, and then there's like an average arch to the foot. So if I'm a foot doctor or foot specialist and I look at a flattened foot, I want to restore that arch somehow. If I'm looking at a foot that has its very high arch, they just support the high arch. There isn't this like effort to try to flatten and high arched foot. Trying to jam someone into this like arch of the foot, not paying the respect to how the foot needs to supinate and pronate as we go through. Because like what you're saying about, so I need to have an adaptable foot that allows for a shape change, because the foot is the final point of putting force down through the ground. It's how I deliver force. The final part of my body that delivers force into the ground to keep me propelling myself forward through space.
Yeah.
I have to have that ability to flatten the foot and then regain the arch. So it's like a spring.
It's going to depend when we get into levels of performance. There's adaptations that consequence that you're describing, which we would consider normal relative motions. You wouldn't want that.
Let's start with normal. We're starting with normal relative motion, foot behavior, shoe choices, and then we'll do performance after that. Let's do that.
Yeah, we can do that. Okay.
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. So
let's talk about normal foot behavior through propulsion.
Sure. Sure. From a superimposition of internal and external rotation, if we were just to step forward, we'll just say we're stepping forward with the right foot goes down. There has to be certain contacts with the foot that allow the superimposition of internal rotation on the external rotation. They're both present at the same time. Okay. Which is really hard for people to grasp. And I understand that, right? That's why we have this whole network of stuff that we talk about, right? So people can understand this, because external rotation represents the space in which you are moving into, and then the internal rotation represents the amount of downward force that you're applying into the ground. So again, both are there, because they're not these just pure turn inwards, turn outwards kind of thing, the way that we're taught in three planes of motion. Okay. So we have this foot that has to be in a position that it can make ground contact in a space and then start to absorb energy from the foot contact upward into the body, because this is the energy that we're actually going to use to propel ourselves forward. So we have to be able to take energy in and take advantage of this and then throw it back down into the ground. And that's how we would move forward, whether we're walking, whether we're running, going into and out of a cut, whatever it may be. Okay. So that's the first foot that we need. This is a foot that has an external rotation bias to it. So in most circumstances, people would say that, okay, it is a measure of supination that we would see represented, because it is an ER bias, right? But when we have heel contact and first metatarsal head contact in what we would consider an optimal scenario, this is actually going to allow the foot to start to change shape. So we can actually take significant advantage of that energy storage, because we have to move towards a foot that can push straight down into the ground as our center of gravity moves up and over the foot. And so that's that first foot, right? So it's a foot that slows us down. Okay. That slow down is connective tissue behavior, right? In that foot. So again, the certain amount of muscle activity that we have to land with, a certain position that we have to land with, and then we then absorb that energy as we move up and over the foot. So that's the first foot that we need. That's the foot that gives us the greatest potential for relative motion because of the degree of muscle activity that would be present. Yeah. And so we chase this foot a lot in situations where somebody has a decrease in performance, a pain-related phenomenon, or just a mechanical position that does not allow them to access motion somewhere. So we will use the foot a lot because, again, we were talking about the upstream effects at the very beginning of this. It's like those upstream effects start because that is our interface with the ground. And so we have to have a foot that does have the ability to change shape.
Okay. So talking about early, middle, and late propulsion, also thinking about it from the perspective of heel striking the ground, rolling through the midfoot, ankle starts to rock forward, heel comes off the ground, weight shifts to the forefoot, pushing off of the big toe, that sort of heel rocker, ankle rocker, toe rocker paradigm.
Sure, you could use that.
It's used. The three stages of propulsion represented in the foot.
Yeah.
What we're trying to, with normal foot behavior, you go into it with that heel strike, foot is in a more ER supinated position. As you progress over the foot, you get IR in a wave. So that as the heel strikes, you get the heel to start to IR, then you get the midfoot to start to IR, you get the forefoot to start to IR, and then you push off of the inside of the foot.
Can we stop where the foot goes down for a sec, though?
Sure. When its foot is flattened into the middle?
Not quite there. So this is when we first get this full ground contact, if you will. Under most circumstances, sure, it'll feel like the full foot ground contact. Okay. We want to understand kind of how we get there. All right. Gravity provides most of the influence to get the foot down to the ground. Mm-hmm. So if we have too much muscle activity, so a high motor output, very stiff connective tissue behaviors, what happens is we never actually access that position because it is gravitational. So we have muscles that are resisting that scenario to get the foot back down. This is where we're going to start to see interference. So it's very important that we understand that this is a gravitational influence to create a foot shape that allows us to accumulate and store this energy, because what we're going to have to do in this circumstance is we're going to have to start pushing down into the ground. And to push down to the ground, we have to have enough internal rotation present. So if I have too much muscle activity that holds the eoid position and prevents us from accumulating this internal rotation, we're in a little bit of a pickle, because now we're going to start that's where the compensatory strategies lie. And so from an optimal standpoint, this is again why we have to have a rear foot that can IR, a midfoot that can IR, and a forefoot that can actually create the position of the foot to allow this to perpetuate upwards.
Yeah.
And this is why shoes matter, because if I have a shoe that prevents me from accessing this position by accident, because I really like these pretty colored shoes, or somebody says I should be wearing these type of shoes, or they accuse you of being an overpronator, and then they put you in a supinated shoe, and then it's too, like, you got one of those shoes that has the lateral heel that's chopped off and holds you in supination all day long. It's like, then you don't perpetuate the optimal representation to absorb the energy.
Because if you were walking with your toes out on the falling towards the forefoot and the inside of your foot, and I just crank you onto the outside of your foot and don't allow you to get back to the inside of your foot, I've just created a problem on top of a problem.
Yeah. Then we never get to that nice forceful middle propulsive representation, which would be equivalent to pushing straight down into the ground as you're moving forward through space.
Right. So the important thing to take away from that would be, we're talking about shape change over time of a foot. Mm-hmm. And the starting position of that, and that shape that we want, is that arch, eoid position of the foot, relatively speaking. As I go through that heel, So Bill is showing the early heel rocker portion of the foot.
Yeah, this is that first important position where we got where the first metatarsal comes down the ground. Tibia is still behind the foot, but you can see that the arch is still present.
Right.
Right.
Yeah. And that is when we're talking about bringing shoes into, or insoles into the equation, that is just to provide support to allow you to capture that shape that you need for that heel rocker early propulsion section of your propulsion, three steps of propulsion. Yeah. And then as your weight shifts out over the foot and you start to, and your tibia starts to come over the foot, that foot starts to flatten into the ground, you get into that pronating, IRing foot position. Okay. Yeah,
so to get to here, we have to go IR rear foot, IR midfoot, because the IR brings the arch down out of the way. So if I have an arch that wouldn't move, the tibia hits this space and it can't go forward. So it has to go around it, or it has to pick the heel up too soon. Right. And so we want to make sure that we have IR that perpetuates through the rear foot, through the midfoot, and then that's what allows the tibia to translate over the foot. And this is our middle propulsive representation. So this is actually a lower arch position, and we have a lot of internal rotation represented. And this is upstream internal rotation. So we see the tibia internally rotate. We see the IR shape of the pelvis. We see a hip that can internally rotate, and that's what allows us to push straight down into the ground.
Right. So that as I strike the heel, that energy, that wave will propagate up. Mm-hmm. It goes all the way up to your skull, smacks the back of your skull, and goes all the way back down.
And it's really fast.
Very fast.
It's really fast. So here's how fast it goes. We talked about this recently, didn't we? You and I?
It's hard to remember.
Okay. So it takes about 10 milliseconds.
Yeah.
Okay. We did talk about so to give you a comparison. So 10 milliseconds, and this is from, it's from proximal tibia to teeth is actually the 10 milliseconds, but we can use that as a general representation. To blink an eye is like a normal eye blink under normal circumstances is about 100 milliseconds. To give you an idea. So this is
a tenth of that.
So this is a tenth of that. That's how fast this energy will propagate up to the basically to your skull. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Okay.
So it's pretty fast.
Yeah. Right? So we got
so we're in this middle range. So there's our there's our middle P foot, right, which is a lot of IR represented. And then we're gonna see the reemergence of ER as we break the heel from the ground. Right. And so this is the first release. So this is a big release of energy, but it's a high force position because it's the most IR representation that we have. So as we break this off, the ER starts to come back. And now we're going to be in this late representation. So the tibia is actually moving away from the foot, relatively speaking, because the heel is coming up into this ER position. And this is a release of energy. So in this position, we have this really big energy storage in the connective tissues. Right. So think about like twisting and stretching these connective tissues and then bam, we get this release. And that's what picks the heel up and gets us into this position, which is our late ER representation. So again, we've got the ER position of the foot. So again, the terminology typically used would be a resupination, if you will, or supination. Right. But the tibia is actually moving back away from the foot. So it looks a lot like that foot, but it's up like that because we have a differences in connective tissue behavior, which changes what appears to be the representation in the foot. Yeah.
So you got ER supination, IR pronation, ER resupination.
Right. And these are biases. They're biases again, because both are present. Both are present.
Because we're still in contact with the medium. There will always be force production in that, in that case. So there is always IR happening. There is always ER happening. It's more like thinking about it from dimmer switches. Like one is cranked up while the other one is not as cranked up, but they're still there.
Yeah.
Or that superimposition sort of idea, but I feel like that's harder for people to grasp.
How about basic trouble?
Yeah, whatever. I mean, I just think of the little the little dials, like dimmer switches for lights, or the little like slider boards that a music producer might use. But we're playing the reiteration game. So I'm just going to keep saying the same thing over and over again, hoping that people won't get annoyed. So in the early phase of propulsion, I get heel strike. I have a supinated foot.
Yep.
So I am going into the force absorption phase of things. Uh-huh. So I've created a shape. So the problem.
Can we say energy absorption to be a little bit more accurate?
Energy absorption. Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay. Energy absorption. I've created the potential to start to store energy and absorb it.
Yeah.
And as I start to go out over the foot, and in a normal, we're talking about normal circumstances here. I get the IR of the rear foot, then the IR of the midfoot.
Yep.
I start to flatten my foot to the ground. That is my middle propulsion. Ankle rocker state of someone would refer to as gait, or we're talking about propulsion.
Okay. And then I'm going to say that is very connective tissue-y.
Yes. And what you mean
not
by
a
that
lot
is
of motion. Not a lot of motion taking place there.
So muscles are tightest. There's a lot of tension in muscle tissue to hold things in place. And then the springy elastic nature of connective tissues is what's going to imagine pulling on a rubber band to then release the rubber band.
Correct.
That the hand, my hand that's holding the stationary point of the rubber band is the muscles holding everything in place in middle propulsion to allow me to get the connective tissue behavior that Bill is saying to get a return of energy.
Yes.
That's
yes.
what makes things elastic and bouncy.
Yes.
Otherwise, you try to grind your way through it. You try to muscle your way through something. That's when stuff starts to break or give or strain.
So let me give you an example so people can distinguish the difference between the connective tissue behavior and then the muscle orientation behavior. Okay.
Yes.
All right. So you're walking on a sidewalk barefoot. Very connective tissue-y. You're walking on a soft sand beach. Very muscly. So if you've ever done both, on the same day at this, like in an alternate, like I'm walking to the beach on the sidewalk and then I get into the sand and it's like, then the calves start to burn and you feel the amount of effort that it takes just to take a normal step. So that's the difference. So walking on the sidewalk is kind of bouncy and elastic. And then walking on the sand dampens all of that and requires much more muscle orientation to produce the walking, because I have to tense so hard to try to store and release energy in those connective tissues, where when you're on the firmer surface, it happens almost automatically.
Right.
So that'll give you a distinguishing characteristic in that middle range. Right.
Okay. So we're in that middle fully. I've pronated. I have flattened the foot. Middle of the foot is IRing towards the ground right before the moment of maximum delivery of energy, where my heel breaks the ground. That's the max propulsion moment, like that had that split second where it just breaks the floor. And then that's when I start to get up over my toe rocker position, up over the metatarsals, and I get a resupination and ERing.
Yep.
So that ER is how I display velocity after the force production.
Yes.
It's necessary component to fly through space, to carry myself off of the ground, away from gravity, is that re-ER, resupination of the foot.
Yes.
And then I have the flight phase, and then I get the foot to come down again.
Yeah.
So that is normal foot behaviors. The shape, those are the shapes that we want to see the foot go through.
Right.
That these are the things that, and then when we're looking at static representations and starting points, when someone's just standing in front of us and they're cranked onto the outside of their foot and their foot doesn't pronate, or their weight's really far forward and they're collapsed in through the midfoot, that shape as they move through space is very likely not going to provide them with one of the three, or maybe all of those phases of propulsion. It's like they're not even going to be able to enter into it.
Okay, so yes, so they will be limited. They will be limited in their expression or the amount of time that they can spend in any one phase.
Sure.
Because
they might,
from a performance standpoint, it becomes a time factor, right?
Because
we'll see what some people might brand as like an unfortunate foot, and then we find that same person runs like a 4.440.
Yeah, I don't want to jump to the athletic foot yet. I feel like we still got to keep hammering the normal foot mechanics here.
Okay.
So we went.
I thought
we covered
the norm.
I know, but like, I really want to make sure people get. I'm trying to like really make sure people are picking up what we're putting down, because we see what the questions that people ask to us that are more informed, and it's maybe because we haven't explained it well enough. But that was three. So early, middle, late propulsion, heel rocker, ankle rocker, toe rocker. Supination, pronation, resupination, all of these things we want to have the foot be able to express a quote unquote neutral middle position as we're looking at them standing with their feet next to each other, because that will let us know potentially that there is a bandwidth to work with. If they're all the way on stuck on one side in ER, or they're collapsed through the midfoot.
Okay, they don't have like collapse. push down through the midfoot. Yes.
Push down through the midfoot.
Okay. It's not a collapse. It's not a giving way.
Clarify for everyone the difference between collapse or push down.
Okay. All right. So here, use construction. Stone archway.
Yes.
People know what a stone archway looks like. Pull the keystone out. Arch collapses. It falls, mechanically speaking.
Right.
Right. So people associate that. They say arch of the foot. Oh, if the arch is low, it must have collapsed. No, it got shoved into the ground.
Right.
There is a force.
Something is holding it
down
there.
That is pushing it into the ground. Like, it's not falling.
Right.
Right. It's not collapsing. That would be like, oh, there's nothing I can do. It's like, no, that is an individual that's pushing hard into the ground, is applying a force into the ground, which is pushing the foot into that position. The minute you start thinking collapse, it becomes this passive thing that they have no control over.
Yeah. But the force is on.
I don't want to perpetuate that thought.
I understand that the forces on the foot that create the shape change over time, though, will cause more plastic change and bones to bend and foot shapes to become more
that doesn't change the reasoning as to how it got there. It's sure. like you will see feet that appear to have an absence of an arch, and you take them off of their feet, and then they have an arch in the foot. And it's like yeah. it's like that's again, I just don't want to perpetuate. Like if I hold you in that position long enough, can you have an adaptation that alters the connective tissue behavior to such a degree that the foot would appear to be lacking the capacity to assume an arch? Absolutely, you can. But that doesn't mean it fell there. It means it got shoved there and right. held down. Right? It's like again, I hate this passivity, right? It's like, yes, gravity allows us to assume the R-head position, but to go past that, you have to push it into the ground, right?
Right.
Because you're moving into a position. Hang on. You're moving into a position. This is a misrepresentation of what's happening in middle propulsion, is because people think that they're because the passivity allows the IR to accumulate, to hold that down past the point where the connective tissue would have resisted the position enough that it can actually store and release. You have to push it past that point. And then it becomes, as you stated, a plastic representation. But that was not the passive nature that we're talking about to assume the IR position that gravity produces. That is beyond that. That is an additional downward force that you are applying into the ground to hold it down and to create that plastic representation.
Right. And the lack of the ability to get into like the earlier phases of propulsion that are going to allow that wave to go from heel to toe are based on what you had mentioned earlier, where we have to have the space created first to yes. then put the force in the IR down into that space. Mm-hmm. That's what that superimposition concept is.
Correct.
So when I've squeezed and compensated my movement over the years and over time, yeah. I don't have as much space available from front to back. I yeah. might be too far forward in my base of support. So as my foot yes. hits the ground, I'm almost skipping over early propulsion. I can't create the shape because I don't have the space available.
Well, you can't slip. So the arch provides a rate of movement through the foot.
Yes.
Like there's a sequence of events. Rear foot would move, midfoot would move, forefoot would move. Okay. So the harder I push down and the greater the degree of give way into this IR position, the faster the tibia will move over the foot. That,
yeah.
So we can't not talk about performance at this point, because that's how right. people run really fast.
Yeah, I believe.
But there are people right. that are not well designed to move fast through space, that have a center of mass that goes forward too fast. It shoves their foot into the ground, and then they lose the capacity to slow the foot down. And so these are the people that will get accused of flat feet, low arches,
yeah.
Collapse, right? Now, I need to throw something out. Mm-hmm. Little kids early on, because of their physical structures, they lost the lottery of life. Two people got together and they made a baby that is half one of them and half the other. And the unfortunate circumstance is that kid's center of gravity is going to move a certain way when they learn to walk. And what they're going to end up with is they're going to end up with bony adaptations that perpetuate mommy or daddy's foot that doesn't have an arch. Okay. So it's still a center of gravity thing. It's still a shape change thing. It's still a push down into the ground. Again, I want to reiterate that, right? You can't always fix it because, again, from a genetic standpoint, their center of gravity behaves a certain way. Some people get to run fast and jump high, and some people get to become accountants. That's kind of how it works. We need yeah. to understand that there's going to be a genetic component of this, but it has to do with how the mass is moving over the foot.
Right.
Okay.
Right. Yeah, and the rate at which that IR sequence wave is occurring. So that in the literature, correct. I think it's actually referred to as pronation velocity or something yeah. along those lines. It's,
sure.
It's when if the rate at which the rate matches up. So what they're seeing is mm-hmm. they're looking at it as like pronation as a sort of definitive bipolar pronation supination thing. And they're just like, okay, yes. this is a pronated foot. This is a supination foot. But it's actually from back to from rear foot to forefoot is starting to pronate in a wave. So it's the rear foot goes, midfoot goes, yeah, forefoot goes.
It's yeah. both being present, right?
Yeah, yeah. It's, and then so yeah. that what they're seeing with that pronation velocity is like the midfoot starts to fall sooner than it should. So the heel might not fall the rate at which they start to collapse as they start to push down their foot into the ground. Uh-huh. Is quicker than what they would like to see as the yes. weight as the person travels over their foot.
Right. This is a combination of shape change. This is a combination of shape, pre-existing shape, shape change, center of mass moving over the foot.
Okay. So 30 minutes after talking about what normal foot behavior is and saying in the beginning that we're going to talk about shoes. Probably talk about shoes. So
let's talk about shoes.
So the normal foot behaviors we've explained at length, hopefully. Everyone's picking up what we're putting down. The shapes that we want available as we go through the three stages of propulsion.
Yeah.
We want to utilize – so the way that we – Bill and I would want to utilize a shoe is to allow for the shapes and the rate of IR to happen authentically, not kind of forced, not letting like getting someone the ability to like relieve their compensation strategies in a way as they go through space.
I would look at it from a timing perspective.
Okay. Let's talk about shoe choice. Utilizing shoes from a timing perspective.
Okay. So let's talk about where there is no time first.
Okay.
Okay. All right. Where time actually stops.
Yes.
Okay. I'm going to show the representation. Okay. So hang on. There we go. All right. So remember, this was the early, this is middle, this is the, that's the late. Late's going this way. Got it? Okay. So we're talking about that one. So this is the dead center pushing straight down into the ground, middle propulsive foot. So this would have the more IR in the foot. It's going to be a lower representation of the arch. And this is me pushing straight down into the ground. Okay. We would love to be able to do that in almost every circumstance because this is how we push into the ground and the ground pushes back up into us. We get that kind of a look on the foot. Life is pretty good. Okay. If we move into an earlier representation, that's going to be an ER representation. If we move into the late, that's going to be an ER representation. So we've got this nice little middle ground representation that we can use sort of as our marker. Okay. And so let's talk about shoes that allow us to do this to the greatest degree first. Because the greatest shoe of all time also gives us this representation.
Stick around for the later in the podcast.
My favorite shoe in the whole world does this, right? And so when you look at, can we use performance now? Can I talk about performance a little bit?
No, we're talking about shoes for normal foot behavior.
All right. So think about it. It's like, so if the arch would be its lowest representation with an optimal circumstance of early, middle, and late, it's a shoe that is relatively even front to back. So in shoe lingo, it would have a very low heel drop. So the heel drop is the difference between the height of the rear foot and the height of the forefoot, right? And so the old the zero drop shoes are indicative of the fact that the sole is level from heel to forefoot, right? And so that would be something that looks like kind of like that. And this has a little bit of a drop to it, but it does represent like a court shoe. You wouldn't want an elevated heel on a court shoe because you're more likely to sprain an ankle. And so this is I'll give a shout out to my buddy Jim Ferris. This is the Jim Ferris Jordan. So that would be a shoe that would be very strongly middle propulsive because of the style of activity that would take place on that foot, right? Mm-hmm. So anything that would fall into like your zero drop categories, even your like the barefoot representations of shoes should allow that middle propulsive representation to be recognized. Okay.
Yeah, I mean we're talking right now about choosing a shoe that's going to help us express normal foot shape change and foot behavior.
Yes.
While we move from early to late propulsion. So when we construct a shoe like that, you're saying given a foot that is, when we're looking at it, is adaptable, has the capability and capacity to go through early, middle, and late and change the shapes necessary.
Yes.
We want something that is going to be have relatively little heel to toe drop that allows the foot to flatten and then regain the arch.
Yeah.
And then it's going to have the flexibility in the toe to allow you to get into that toe rock position.
Yeah, so that's the toe box. That's
better. Yeah. So just in order to maintain and attain the shapes that we need a shoe. So we'll talk about what we look for in shoes. One of the things you want when you want to have the heel hit the ground in a stable position to allow that heel strike to start to IR and then the midfoot to IR, you want something with a solid heel counter. So I have an example and Bill has an example. You can knock on it, you can push on it, you can push down from the top and it doesn't collapse. So this is a very visual episode, so if you're on Spotify, you might want to head to YouTube to check it out. But Bill and I are pushing down on the from the back of the shoe, and there isn't any give to the heel.
Yeah,
there's a pretty flat representation at the heel from side to side. It's not pitched one way or the other into eversion or inversion to force the shape that if someone quote unquote over pronates, you don't want to just jam them into a supinated position. If we're trying to restore normal movement behaviors, looking for a solid midsole. So as I go through, as I want the most stiffness, as I want the most compression, as I want the most muscle contraction, as I want time to stop and to resist forward motion, I want a midsole that doesn't bend in half. So what did you call it? What's the strut? What is the thing that's in the middle of a shank. Yeah. So technical term for a shoe.
Well, some shoes will just change the density of the foam. And then some shoes will actually put in a more plastic.
So here's a minimalist shoe. As you can see, the heel counter is not stiff. It folds on itself. It bends from side to side. The midfoot just completely folds like a pancake. I can twist it in any direction whatsoever. It's basically a sock with shoelaces on it.
Can I share a screen? Show. This is a problem. This is a problem because this is a basketball shoe.
Yes.
So that's a big problem. So the reason that we don't want a flexible midsole in many circumstances is because the foot should not bend in this position, right? This is kind of a big deal because this shoe actually perpetuates the compensatory internal rotation through the midfoot that can actually cause a lot of problems. So you're going to see a lot of like midfoot sprains. You're going to see what would be accused of being plantar fasciitis.
Is that a high ankle sprain mechanism?
Not necessarily, because the IR is going to drop in front of the ankle under this circumstance. Okay. But I'll give you, for instance, like this shoe perpetuated a situation where a cyst developed on somebody's flexor hallucis longus tendon. They required surgery to resolve it, right? And so, again, it's just too much pressure in the wrong place because the foot tried to bend in the middle of the foot. We want the toes to be able to bend. Yes. We want to make sure that the rear foot can change its shape, but we don't want to bend through the foot in a place where it should not bend.
Right.
So you're bending the toe box on this shoe, which is that's where it should bend. That makes total sense.
So a toe box that bends, like Bill's saying, right along the line of like the metatarsal joints.
Yeah.
So that's where I want to have that final toe rocker position.
Yes.
And that allows me to deliver that final bit of force and then resupinate the foot. So in review, we want a solid heel counter that's pretty level from side to side.
Okay. Can I talk about the heel counter for a sec?
Sure.
Okay, so the reason that you want a rigid heel counter is not to hold the ankle or hold the rear foot still. It's so that you can feel where the rear foot is.
Okay.
So if you stick your fingers, one reason I love the shoe you've got in your hands, because when you stick your fingers inside of the shoe around where the rear foot is, there's actually a pad that hugs the calcaneus.
Yeah.
But it doesn't restrict it from moving. It just gives it a physical contact. So you get a lot of sensation as to where the rear foot is.
So I might have said stabilize when I meant to say control. or provide for it, the sensation.
It provides sensation for sensation. The control of the rear foot. It's like,
It's like a it's a preface. It's the sensation that allows the, like this sort of feed forward mechanism.
It's not a passive. It's not a passive constraint as much as it is a way for you to sense something. It's like a leading resistance, if you will.
Yeah. Well, the opposite would be, I'll have no reference. There might be a cup to this, but it's not going to be enough to give me the sensation to know that I'm IRing my heel too early, or I'm stuck in ER at my heel.
Right.
It's not enough because it gives too much, and I can just sort of settle into either position. Yeah. While this one does not give as much, I can feel the difference, and I can learn. I can learn that rolling control through the rear foot. Okay. Yes, so the heel counter is solid. I got good secure control of the calcaneus, the sensation provided to allow people to start that IR wave from the rear foot towards the forefoot. The midsole has a solid, it's solid in nature. It doesn't bend. So that when I am in this position of that orthogonal 90 degrees down force, everything needs to be stiffest. Time stops. That's where I want to be my solid in the shoe. As I go into the toe rocker, toe box is flexible. There's also enough space in the toe box. That's important because if all of my toes are squeezed together, that's going to limit my ability to display external rotation or movement of the foot that's necessary to propel myself forward through space.
Yeah. You just want enough space. You just want enough space. You don't want to exaggerate the spread of the toes.
Yeah, I wanted to say.
Let's ignore those people.
Right. Let's not say we want. We don't need toe shoes. We don't need toe spacers. We're not trying to like reclaim what a chimpanzee's foot looks like, or like some tribe in Africa has splayed toes. So that's what we need to try to acquire. I don't know. But anyways, I hope that me talking about this over and over again has sort of allowed people to understand what we're looking for in a shoe.
Don't worry. The six people that listen to this are still listening, Chris.
So normal foot behavior, what we're looking for those people with a normal shoe, when we're not dealing with normal foot behavior, we can choose shoes and insoles and different types of things to put into shoes to influence shape of the foot. Yeah. And the subsequent behaviors of that shape that we're able to attain. Because like you had mentioned, when I push down on something, if I get a plastic change and I get a bend through the foot, there might not be a way to, without some support or help from tape or from an insert in the sole of the shoe or from like a proper orthotic even.
Correct.
In order to reclaim the shape that's necessary to move over my foot and propagate that wave in order that I would want to see. So let's talk about that. Like when it comes to like when you would want more of a heel drop, when you would want more of an arch, like things like that.
Okay. So if I want an ER representation, looks like, so this is at either end of the propulsive phase, there should be a differential between the heel and the forefoot. The question mark is how much, right? And so we can kind of see in the representation of the foot, because it is ER'd, I'm going to hold this up again so that you can see it. So there's my one ER and there's my other ER, right? So this one's up. So that immediately starts to look like, that would be like a higher heel toe drop. And that is actually accurate under the circumstance. And so, and there would be certain circumstances, like if I had a plastic change in the rear foot, so a bend in the calcaneus or a bend in the talus that resulted in, they will be accused of overpronation. Okay. So this is somebody that lands in this IR position that is an adaptation within the bone. I would want to elevate that heel because what I would want to do is actually lift the heel up enough so that the calcaneus was actually square to the ground when I made ground contact. And then over time, actually, this is actually kind of cool, is I can start to reshape that rear foot. Okay. So these are the people that are going to use a little bit higher differential between the rear foot and the forefoot. those are typically going to be somebody that has an adaptation literally within the structure of the foot that they need to maintain the ER representation for a much longer period of time. And again, they need to get the calcaneus squared to the ground, which requires the heel elevation to do so.
Right. Okay. And there are differences in that. So when we're talking about heel to toe drop, there are going to be differences in the construction of shoes that are going to lean you more towards an earlier foot shape and some that are going to lean you more towards a later foot shape. So if I have, if I have a shoe that has a, like a ramp on the heel and then flattens out through the forefoot or bends upward in the forefoot, that's going to be more of a late foot shape.
Yeah.
If I have a shoe that is like, if I have a shoe that is like a proper ramp, so I have one gradual plane, so a little bit of like a rounded.
This is going to be more of a later shoe. So because they saw off the back of the shoe here, and because there's a curve upward in the forefoot, that's going to get you into this late representation faster. So this is more of a late shoe.
It puts you back to earlier. It puts you in that toe rocker shape.
Faster.
Yeah. You're going to, it is shaped in a toe rocker way to get you there faster. The rate at which you get there faster. So you will spend more time there. You will bias that position more.
Yes.
If you're talking about something that is more of like a ramp situation where you have the heel, the midfoot and the forefoot all on one line going downhill, that will help create an earlier shape of the foot. Yeah. So these, a lot of times you'll see like some training shoes are this way. Olympic lifting shoes are kind of this way. Bill is showing the differences between like an earlier and a late shoe. Both are going to be a representation of some ER. But if you shove someone in a late shoe forever, you're still restricting their ability to get that early expansion that you might be necessary to alleviate symptoms or acquire range of motion.
Yeah, they may not be able to capture the energy storage. So they're getting propelled forward too fast.
Yes.
They get too much stiffness in the foot. Okay. If they would have like a 4-foot deformity, you're going to emphasize that because the amount of internal rotation that you're going to perpetuate through the foot would be reduced in the rear and the midfoot and then magnified in the forefoot. And this is where you're going to see something like a bunion would get magnified by putting somebody in a late shoe for a lengthy period of time.
Knee pathologies and symptoms will.
Oh yeah, yeah,
yeah.
Anterior knee pain with a late shoe usually ends up in a little bit of a pickle.
Mm-hmm. People that think that since these shoes are good for their running and walking, that they're going to like exercise and lift weights in them, can often find those are the people that you might start to have like anterior knee pain when they're doing a split squat or their knees always kind of bug them when they do squats and stuff like that. Think about that from that perspective, where the foot shape and how they're putting force down into the ground and the shape of the foot that's not able to go through that early, mid, late representation that we're talking about, that could be part of the reason. So it's always something to consider.
Well, so you bring up a really, really valid point here. It's like, so people that would do their strength training in a late propulsive shoe that complain about anterior knee pain, either on the front knee or the back knee in a split squat. So think about this for a second.
Yeah.
In the late propulsive shoe, the knee is actually should be straightening in that circumstance. So from the ground up, here's the signal that we were talking about before. This is the upstream effect, right?
Yeah.
So down at the foot, everything seems all fine and wonderful because I got this heel elevation and I got this foot thing. But the signal from the foot says, knee, stay straight. And then you're going to go, no, I'm going to bend the knee against these mechanics. And now you wonder why you have knee pain, right? So you're squatting with the wrong shoe on. You're doing your single leg activities with your knee bent, with the wrong shoe on, and it's the fault of the foot position and the shoe contributing. I wouldn't say it's entirely that fault,
right,
but it's a contributor.
Okay. So we've talked about, if I have a foot that isn't adapting the way that I want, it doesn't allow me access to this early, mid, late in the order of propulsion that I'd want to see the wave from rear foot to forefoot. we're going to use a shoe to sort of meet the person where they are as a starting point. And then we're going to over time, try to work them towards being able to use that middle of the road representation shoe that allows them to put the IR and the middle P where it's supposed to be down within their base of support. So it's like not always picking one style of shoe and using it forever, but right. knowing where you are in compensation land or in which part of the season you're in as an athlete and utilizing a shoe based on what your body needs to do or what bias you need to kind of live within at the given time.
Yeah.
So we have someone that someone has an issue capturing an early foot position. I put them in, you know, something that is, like we were saying, more of a ramp orientation. I slowly start to lower the heel to toe drop so that I can see if I can get them to a flatter shoe representation. Can they acquire that? Can they start from the early position, get to the middle position, and then push off to the late position that I would like to see?
Yeah. Earlier shoes will fall into the category of like, and I'm just, again, giving a ballpark estimate.
Yeah.
An eight millimeter drop is sort of like an average early propulsive shoe. And then when you break 10 and higher, now you're into this late propulsive shoe, which means that you better be running really fast in that shoe for the foot behavior to match the shoe behavior.
Yes.
Right. But a lot of times when we're working with people that would have like painful conditions, limitations in relative motions, we're looking for those early shoes. So again, we want that ER bias, but we can still superimpose a fair amount of IR onto that.
Yeah. And thinking about it too. So I'll give an example of how I've utilized shoes with some athletes before during certain points of the season, or even you can do it from a micro or macro sense. So if I'm in an early off season period and I'm trying to recapture ranges of motion, relative motions, expansion, recovery, I might put someone in an earlier shoe to train. We're going to do our tempo runs in an earlier shoe. We might even train in the gym with an earlier shoe, or I might utilize like ramps more often to try to get that person to come back. I mean, I'm not explaining this to you. I'm explaining this to the listeners. As you're like, yeah,
I get it.
And then as the middle of the season, preseason comes, I'm about to go into my most competitive phase. I might flatten them to the ground, use a more middle propulsive
high
shoe.
Force. High force. Yes.
A lot of compression, you know, and then when we go late season, postseason, everything's fast. Everything's late, you know, from all the angles and aspects. I have someone train in a later shoe.
Yeah.
And
it's like top speed. Like if you were to just compare like just again rate of movement across the ground and you say, well, if I got to get to top speed mechanics, it's like, okay, well how? And there's a big argument where the heel actually hits the ground at top speed and all that kind of stuff. And it does by accident a lot of times. But no, you're going to put them in a faster shoe. That's your late propulsive shoe for sure.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Okay, I feel like I've hit on the same things over and over again enough.
Okay,
I think if we want to talk about the performance foot, we should just do another episode. Like we'll do like a quick 20-minute, 30-minute episode about the performance foot.
Yeah,
because it is a little bit weird. We want, and if I got a sprinter, I want compensations. I want the most beneficial compensations I can get out of them. And the closer that person's foot is to that maximum propulsion, the better. So that might mean,
it's the time constraint.
It might mean a flat, because we're trying to create a shape of a foot that delivers the force quickest. So if I lock things together, that's going to be a quick propagation of energy.
If it's
relative motions are there, and it's a nice
that's force into the ground,
it's a nice wave to it. It'll be a nice slow gradual wave from rear to forefoot with relative motions, which is good for not feeling stiffness and, you know, symptoms that are going to arise in different parts of your body, but that's not going to be what's best for force production and performance.